cover a few topics from the Seder if we have time. Start with a major one. What exactly was the sin of the spies? Chet HaMeraglim. There are quite a few problems here. One is, the Torah starts with Shlach Lecha Anoshim. Moshe Rabbeinu, you send them. So the Medrash says, first of all, before we get to what I want to speak about, I'll tell you something nice for the sake of the women. The Kli Yoker says, Shlach Lecha Anoshim. Moshe Rabbeinu, in the final analysis, it's going to be to your benefit if you send men. Because the men are going to sin, and you're going to have to stay in the desert for 40 years, and since you're not allowed to go into Eretz Israel, your life's going to be expended 40 years. But if you'll send women, the women did not sin, and then you'll have to go into Eretz Israel right away, your life's going to be shortened by 40 years. So it's in the end result, good for you that you're sending men and not women. Okay, in any case. But the Medrash says that Moshe Rabbeinu came to ask God. He said, the Jews want to send spies and to see what the land is like. What should I do? God said, I'm not telling you to send them. If you want to send them, you can send them, but I'm not telling you to send them. And Moshe Rabbeinu sent them. Now, if I was Moshe Rabbeinu and God told me, look, I don't think it's a good idea. I'm not going to tell you to send them. But if you want to send them, yes, why in the world would Moshe Rabbeinu send them? So you'll say that Moshe Rabbeinu didn't realize that there's a problem, that these people were plotting something. But the Torah seems to say that. Kulam Anoshim, they were all were great people. And Rashi brings down, Malamed Shohayu Tzadikim Ba'ososhah, they all were righteous at that time. So if that's the case, why did Moshe Rabbeinu daven for Yoshua before he sent them? God should save you from the plot of the spies. Moshe Rabbeinu knew there was a plot. So if he knew there was a plot, why did he send them? And God already told him, he's not telling him to send them. So why in the world would he send them? And it seems to be that there was already a plot. If there was already a plot, that they weren't tzaddikim. They already were plotting to do bad. So how could it say they all were anoshim tzaddikim? And thirdly, or fourthly, whichever we're up to, right, it says in the Torah, Vayelchu Vayavo. They went and they came back. Rashi says, to tell me that just like when they came back, they already had a bad plot, when they left, they also were plotting. And therefore they were Rishoyim to begin with. That contradicts what Rashi said, that when he sent them, they were all Tzadikim. So what's going on here? So in order to understand this, I want to explain the following. The Vilna Gaon says that even though God deals with the Jewish people, or deals with the world in fact, in many different ways, that is how we see it. But how it really is that God is controlling the world in all situations at all times. God is the one who calls the shots. There's some times that we can see that openly. That's called Hashgacha Nisis. That's what happened in the desert, where as soon as they did a sin, right away there was fire that came down from the heavens to punish them, or snakes came to punish them. It was immediate. You could see. Or they had a cloud of glory in the daytime and a pillar of fire at night, and God's presence was there on the Mishkan, and everything was miraculous. They had to eat. Man came down from the heavens. They had a drink, there was a be'er that accompanied them. Everything was miraculous. That's one way that God deals with the world, where you can see his involvement openly. Then there is what was going to happen in Eretz Israel. When they came to Eretz Israel, there's no more man falling from the sky. People are going to have to plant and plow and irrigate and harvest, and that's how you eat. Okay? That's called Hashgacha Tivis. But there, it also was with hidden miracles. How so? Because there, whether there would be crops, whether there would be rain, depended not on high systems, low systems, or whatever, right? But on are the Jews keeping Torah and mitzvahs or not? The weatherman would get on the television, radio, wherever he is, and he would say, "We've made a survey, and most Jews are keeping mitzvahs. There's going to be rain tomorrow." He didn't say, you know, we calculate there's going to be rain because it's a high-pressure system, a low-pressure system. And that is hidden miracles because there's no real open connection between Torah and mitzvahs and rain. But that's nature then when according to the Torah. And now we live in a time when we don't even see that. We are living in a time what's called hesterponim, where God's face is hidden, and we don't see a connection between Torah and mitzvahs of the workings, the natural workings of the world. We see cause and effect of other kinds of causes and effects, political, social, economic causes that seem to create effects. Says the Vilna Gaon, it's not that God changes his divine providence with the world at different times. God is always controlling and causing what happens in the world. It only is different in how we see it. We see it openly, we see it hiddenly, we don't see it at all. But it's only from our standpoint. But God's control of the world never changes. The Jewish people knew that when they come to Eretz Yisrael, God's divine providence, how he deals with them, is going to change. And things are going to happen in a natural way. No more man falling from the heavens, but they're going to have to plant, plow, and so on. They made a mistake, and they didn't understand what I just told you now. And they understood that when the things change, they change. And God is no longer the one in control, but he's given over that control to human beings, that things now will happen in a natural way, and when it happens in a natural way, we are the cause. It's our planting, plowing, harvesting that makes the result, which is not really true. It's just that in this mode, God wants us to go through the motions to fulfill a prerequisite of doing things in a natural way, but in the end, he's the one who's the cause. Right? In this mode, you have to go to the doctor, but it's not the doctor who's healing you. The doctor is merely the hishtadlus that you make that God should heal you. We say in Shemoneh Esrei every day, Rofei Chole Amoiso, God is the healer. What happened to all the doctors? And they charge plenty if they're not doing anything, why? Because that is God's will, that it not happen by miracle. Because if it happens in a miraculous way, you won't have free choice. If everything happens in this world miraculously, our free choice would be greatly impaired. So God wants us to go through the motions of doing things in a natural way where we could think that we are the cause and still choose to believe that God is the ultimate cause of everything. So that is the way it really is. But the people didn't understand that. And they understood that when we get to Eretz Yisrael, things are going to happen naturally. If they happen naturally, then we're in control. And we have to make it happen. Okay. That was called Atzas Meraglim, not the plot of the spies to come back and malign Eretz Yisrael. That they didn't have in mind at the time. But they had, in another medrash it says, Atzas Hador Hazeh, the not plot, but the idea, the philosophy of this generation. They made that mistake to think that in the desert, where everything happened miraculously, God was in control. But God relinquished his control and put it in the hands of human beings when they'll come into Eretz Yisrael and everything will happen naturally. If it's happening naturally, we're the cause. And that was a mistake. That was called Atzas Hador Hazeh, the philosophy of this generation, that Moshe Rabbeinu knew they had that philosophy. And therefore, they said, since now we're getting ready to come to Eretz Yisrael, and in Eretz Yisrael, things are going to be different. We're going to be the ones to make we're going to make the causes, so we have to get ready and do things in a natural way. So we want to send spies. Just like any way you conquer a country, first you send spies. So Moshe Rabbeinu went to the Rabbanu Shalom and he said, should I send them or not? God said, I can't tell you to send them. That is defeating the whole purpose. The Jewish people want to now start on the natural progression of things. In the natural progression, you send spies. But in the natural progression, you don't come to ask God if you should send spies. He's not available like that anymore. Now, what do? You go to the Gadol Hador and you ask him, and he tells you, according to his Torah knowledge, what he thinks. So the Rabban Shem told Moshe Rabbeinu, I can't tell you to send the spies or not to send the spies, because the whole purpose over here is to do things according to the new mode, where everything's going to happen naturally. If it happens naturally, you don't come and ask me. So you make the decision. I'm leaving it in your hands. Right? That's what's going to happen when they get to Eretz Yisrael. They're going to ask the Gadol Hador. He's not going to go and ask God. It's going to happen naturally. Naturally means the Gadol is going to have to look in the Torah and understand what God's will is. So you decide. So Moshe Rabbeinu, they have this terrible mistake to think that they're going to go now, and if they can conquer Eretz Yisrael naturally, it can be done. If it can't, then it can't be done, because God has relinquished his control. And Moshe Rabbeinu could have given the shir I'm going to give you now and convinced them, right? Like, I can convince you or convince myself. But there's a very big difference between being convinced intellectually and actually feeling it. Because they're going to have to go fight and really believe that even though they have to fight and they have to do things naturally, ultimately the cause is God. And he hasn't relinquished his control over anything. And everything is exactly as it was in the desert, except doesn't look that way. So therefore Moshe Rabbeinu said, if I tell them they can't go, they'll never really come to grips with what really is. They'll say, yeah, they understand and they accept or whatever, but deep down in their gut, they're still going to have this mistake. Right? Person can say, I believe that God is the healer or whatever, and still, Lamaisi puts his trust in the doctor. Right? If you ask him why he was healed, the doctor healed him. The medicine healed him, or whatever. So you can say, you can believe, but until it becomes real to you, it's not the same thing. So therefore Moshe Rabbeinu said, you know what, I'm going to send them. And they're going to see that they're making a terrible mistake. Why? Because there are three givens. One given is that it's going to happen naturally. Second given is, we can't do it. Third given should be, we don't have to do it. It's going to happen naturally, and God is still making it happen. So even though it appears that we can't do it naturally, doing it naturally doesn't mean that God left it up into our hands. It means that he's going to make it appear as if it happens naturally, but he's still doing it. So even if we can't conquer these nations naturally, and it's going to have to happen naturally, still it's going to happen, because God promised us that we're going to conquer the nations. They came to the wrong conclusion. They came to the conclusion that when we come to Eretz Yisrael, it's going to happen naturally. And we see we can't do it with our own power. That means it can happen naturally. If it can't happen naturally, then it can't happen. And that's why the Meraglim said something that sounds like a kindergarten child wouldn't say. He said, "Ki chazaku mimenu." They saw the nations were so strong, they're even stronger than God. He even can't take... can't do anything. Now, what do they think? That a bunch of people with bows and arrows and spears are stronger than God? Is that with their infantile understanding of what God is? But what they said was true. According to their mistake, that God said things are going to happen naturally. We understand naturally means that we're going to have to make it happen. And God has relinquished his control and put it in our hands. And if we see we can't make it happen, then it can't happen. And God can't make it happen either, because he's tied his hands. And he's told us it's going to happen in a natural way. That's what they came back. And according to their mistake, they were right. But it was a mistake. So Moshe Rabbeinu knew they had this false philosophy. He knew that if they went, the way that they would come face to face with the fact that they're making a mistake is if they would believe that God told them they can conquer the land. And promised them that would happen. Even though God says it's going to happen naturally. And even though they saw they can't do it naturally. So they have to come to the conclusion, happening naturally doesn't mean that we're in control. It doesn't mean that we're the cause. It means that God will make it happen and it'll look natural. But we're not, and we'll do our ishtadlus, we'll go to battle, we'll fire the bows and arrows and the spears, and God will make it work. So they should have come with that conclusion. They came with the other conclusion.
Doesn't that mean that they're kofar be'ikar? No. They don't believe that God is being manhig the world.
No, they believe that God said, when we come to Eretz Yisrael, I'm giving it over into your hands. That's what God said. They just made a mistake to think that when God said it's going to happen naturally, that he relinquished his control. And he gave it. And now things are going to happen naturally. You're in control. That was a mistake. But that's Ratzon Hashem. That's God's will. That's what he says is going to happen. And it's true. That was God's will. But the only mistake they made is that if it's going to happen naturally, it's not because we're in control. God's still in control. He hasn't relinquished his control and put it in our hands. He's just made it that we have to go through the motions in order for it to happen. That's all. But we're only going through the motions. They came to the conclusion that happening naturally means we're in control. And if we can't do it, it can't be done. And not that God can't do it. He could if he wants, but he's this is his will. It's going to happen like this, and it's not going to happen.
One thing they satisfied right after they were in the desert. They weren't in the desert very long before they satisfied.
No, but they were already there a year.
A year or something.
Right. So, and they knew that from the time of the sin of the golden calf, God said, I'm sending an angel. And it didn't happen in Moshe's time, but they knew that when they came to Eretz Yisrael, that angel, the angel of nature, would take over. That's the thing. So, in any case, so therefore, Moshe said, I could give them a long shear and explain to them, but it's not going to change really how they really, really feel. It's going to just change them intellectually. If they go there and they see with their eyes that it's impossible to do naturally, yet God promised that we're going to conquer the land. So how do we resolve this contradiction? God said it's going to happen naturally. We see it's impossible. Conclusion that happening naturally doesn't mean that we're in control. God's still in control. That should have been their conclusion. What was their conclusion? God said it's going to happen naturally. We can't do it. It can't be done. Finished. Moshe Rabbeinu therefore davened for Yahushua. He knew that there was this philosophy, and they all had it. He davened for Yahushua because Yahushua is going to have to lead them in Eretz Yisrael in this new mode. And if he would make the mistake, it would destroy everything. So at least he davened for Yahushua as the leader, that he shouldn't make this mistake. He should come with the right conclusion. He was hoping that all of them would come with the right conclusion. And therefore, when they went, they were tzaddikim. They had a mistaken idea that doesn't make you a Russian until it comes out in something practical. But when it came out to something practical, where can you trace it back to their mistaken philosophy? The mistaken philosophy itself was not bad, didn't make them bad people. But when your mistaken philosophy comes and you come to conclusions that are evil conclusions because of it, then you can trace back those evil conclusions to the false philosophy to begin with. So when they went, they were still tzaddikim. But when their philosophy turned into something negative, practically, you can trace it back to the time when they already left. And therefore, there's an interesting medrash. Moshe Rabbeinu told the spies, "Vishchazakten, strengthen yourselves and take from the fruit of the land." Now, it says that only 10 of them took from the fruit. Okay? So one medrash says, why only 10? Because Yahushua and Kalev didn't take. Because they were not part of this plot. Seems that taking the fruit was part of the plot. And it says, they took fruit, and they said just like the fruit was phenomenally different, right? It was gigantic fruit. So too the people there are gigantic people. So they brought back the fruit as a proof that we can't do anything. So Yahushua and Kalev were not part of the plot. They didn't bring back fruit. Yet there's another medrash that says that Yahushua and Kalev took out their swords and they said, you better take the fruit. And if you don't take the fruit, either we'll kill you or you kill us, but you're going to take that fruit. Completely conflicting medrash. Here it says that Yahushua and Kalev didn't take the fruit because they weren't part of the plot, seeming the fruit was something bad. Here it says that Yahushua and Kalev forced the other ones to take the fruit. Seemingly that was necessary. In addition to all of that, forget about Midrashim, the Torah said Moshe Rabbeinu told them to take the fruit. So how could it be part of the plot? I want to say the following. The Torah said it conditional. V'hischazakte. Strengthen yourselves and take from the fruit. Meaning the following. Sometimes a person has ideas that aren't 100% proper, okay, he should avoid coming face to face with those ideas where they may push him over the threshold. Meaning the following. If you feel that you have to do it naturally, and natural means you're in control, then coming face to face with the fruit is a very dangerous thing. Why? Because there's one thing in Eretz Yisrael that is impossible for a human being to do naturally, and that's to provide his food, because it depends on rain, and human beings can't make it rain. Rain is one thing that even till today is in God's hands. Totally. You can seed clouds, it have to be clouds to seed, and even that is not usually successful. It's about as successful as rain dances. But if there's no clouds, you can't create clouds to seed them. There's no way of creating. If there would be, wouldn't be any droughts throughout the world. There is no way. That is clearly in the hands of God. Now, if you believe that when God said things will happen by nature, that you're still not in control, God's still the one doing it, except to make it look natural, then the rain's no problem. Of course God's going to make it rain, but it's all going to be a natural process. We'll plant and we'll plow, and the rains will come, and rains are part of a natural cycle, and that's it. But if you think that when things happen naturally, you are the cause, then how can you even guarantee your food supply? You can't cause it to rain. So you're, obviously, if you think that God has relinquished his control and he's given over to your hands, you're helpless when it comes to the rain. So if you don't need, if you already believe, don't come in contact with the fruit, because that may push you over the threshold the other way and get you really panicky. But if you're not convinced and you need something to convince you, then come face to face with the fruit. It can't be worse. If you're not convinced that God's in control, the fruit may make you give up. But you already gave up. But the fruit may tell you that it can't be that you're in control, because you can't control the rain. So God, Moshe Rabbeinu said like this, if you still have your mistaken ideas, then v'hischazak them, and you need to be strengthened, take from the fruit. But if you don't need to be strengthened, leave the fruit alone, because the fruit could panic you. So therefore, Yoshua and Kalev, who were convinced of the right philosophy, didn't have to take the fruit. But they forced the other ones to take the fruit because they weren't convinced. And if you're not convinced, Moshe Rabbeinu said, you need to be strengthened, take the fruit. And they, unfortunately, came and used it the opposite way. Instead of coming to the conclusion, look, we made a mistake. We thought if God says that things are going to happen naturally, that he's relinquishing his control and we're in control. But we see from the fruit that can't be. Because if it would be, then there's no way for us to control our food supply. That should have been their conclusion. Instead, they came to the conclusion, you see, we can't even guarantee our food supply, let alone conquering these nations, because God's not in control anymore, and therefore we can't make it rain. Who knows what's going to happen? They panicked. That's the idea. That's why when they came back and the people cried, the crying was feeling abandoned. God abandoned us. He's relinquishing his power in Eretz Yisrael. It's impossible for us to cause it. He's putting it into our hands and we can't do it. And they cried as out of yish, out of total abandon and despair. And therefore the Rabban Hashem said, you're crying tonight out of despair. I'm going to give you a way of correcting this crying in the future, Tisha B'Av. You'll cry on Tisha B'Av. This is Bechia Shelchina. This is a wasted cry. Because God never relinquishes his control, and he never abandons you. There's nothing to despair about. So why do we cry on Tisha B'Av? That is a Bechia Shel Mamash. That is a positive crying. What's a positive crying? I like to compare it to the following. A baby cries. A baby cries, doesn't know exactly what's wrong. It's cold, hot, wet, hungry, it needs to be changed, something. The baby can't conceptualize what's wrong with it. But he knows one thing, that if he cries and makes enough noise, there will soon appear a person, usually in the form of a woman, that will know right away what the problem is and take care of it. That's the crying of a baby. It's not a crying of feeling abandoned and despair, but a crying knowing that even though I don't know what's wrong even, and I surely can't take care of it. If I cry, my mother's going to show up, sometimes a father, right, and know how to take care of things. And one of my sons was maybe 5 or 6. My wife was dressing him for school in the morning, and he said to her, how come mommies do so much for their children and tatis don't do so much? So my wife, being a good wife, said, that's not true. Your tati does things for you. And my son thought for a few seconds. He says, yeah, tati once tied my shoes. That's a famous maise in our family, in any case. But in any case, usually it'll be in the form of a mother that will know right away what to do and take care of the child. That's the crying. Rabbanu Shalom, we're in Golus. And you promised us you're going to redeem us. And we can't do it ourselves. So we're crying, do it for us. The other conclusion, the conclusion the Meraglim should have come to, that's the conclusion we come on Tisha B'Av. We don't cry out of despair. We cry over the fact that things are not right, and we feel they're not right, and we don't know even 100% how to remedy them. But we know that if we cry out to you, Rabbanu Shalom, you'll take care. And even though you say it's going to happen naturally, you'll make sure that it happens naturally. That's the antithesis of what the crying in the Midbar was based on the mistake of the Meraglim. So that is the parsha of the Meraglim, a misunderstanding of what happens when things have to happen naturally. We're not in control. God's still in control. It's going to look natural, but still the Rabbanu Shalom is going to make it happen, and he can make it look natural even if it has to be miraculous. Okay. Any questions on that? We'll go to something else. There was another aspect of the sin of the spies. Vayimoasu be'eretz chenda. They were disgusted with the desired land. They were disgusted with Eretz Yisrael. They maligned Eretz Yisrael. They spoke badly about it. Lecha'ora, that's not the case. They thought Eretz Yisrael is a great place, right? The only problem is that we can't conquer it. But it's not a bad place, right? It's not a place fit for normal people like us under normal natural conditions. It's a land that's only good, right, under supernatural conditions. Only giants there. There's giant fruit. Everything is supernatural. And we're not going to be able to live in that land naturally. And God said we're going to have to live in that naturally. That was the sin. Why does David HaMelech describe the sin as them being disgusted with Eretz Chemda? So I want to say the following. That the word Chemda is lo sachmod. You're not allowed to covet. Right? So the Rambam says something very interesting. When do you transgress the prohibition of chemda? Okay? You go to a wedding and you see a woman with a beautiful gown and you want it. Okay? You're jealous of her. At the moment that you're jealous of that gown, are you over the issur of lo sachmod or not? Says the Rambam, no. Just wanting it, that's not lo sachmod. Right? Torah didn't prohibit wanting something just like this. You know where you're over lo sachmod? If you then call that lady at 3 o'clock in the morning after the wedding and you say, you know, I noticed that gown that you have, it's really exquisite, I'd like it, would you sell it to me? She says, no, it's not for sale, I like this gown too, it's a one of a kind, I'm interested in keeping it for the next wedding. She said, well, what if I offer you double its value, triple its value? She says, no, I'm not interested. You'll call her 4 o'clock in the morning. You sure you're not interested? 5 o'clock in the morning, day after day, until you wear down her resistance. Take the gown already. Right? Then you're over lo sachmod. Lo sachmod is not just wanting it; it's going in through the motions of getting it, even by buying it, right? But if you put through the motions of getting it, then you're what's it called? You're over. Now the Rambam himself seems to contradict himself, because the Rambam says, there's a law that you don't get lashes for a sin that's done without an action. Only for sins that are done with an action. Now, you eat chazer. You've eaten something. So you get malchus if you eat chazer. But if you're over an isser that's just in thought, you don't get malchus. Okay? Just, for instance, what's it called? What would be an isser of thought? That's a lav. Don't go after your eyes or your heart or whatever. If you're over that issue, you don't get malchus. It's only in your mind. It's not an action. You only get malchus for an action. says the Rambam, when you transgress the prohibition of lo sachmod, of coveting what somebody else has, you don't get malchus for it, because the isher is in thought. It's a contradiction. The Rambam says you don't transgress the lo sachmod by thinking. You have to go through the motions of doing something, of bothering the person and eventually getting it because you bothered them enough. Right? So it is something that is dependent on action. Why don't you get lashes for it? So one answer, I think, is the following. The real prohibition is wanting it. But just wanting, how much you have to really want it to be over that issue. How do I know if you really want it, if you do things to get it? If you don't do anything to get it, then you didn't really want it that much. If you went through all these motions and keep calling the person 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the morning, willing to pay extra for it, then you really wanted it. How do we gauge if you want it enough to be considered the prohibition if you go through the motions of getting it? If you do, then you obviously wanted it enough. If you don't, then obviously you didn't want it that much. So what is the prohibition? The prohibition is wanting it. Except you have to go through the motions of getting it to show that you really wanted it. But if you go through those motions, that's not the prohibition. The prohibition is not buying the dress, right, and bothering the person. The prohibition is that you wanted it. Except this shows how much you wanted it. That's when you transgress the prohibition. Therefore, chemda means I want something so much that I'm willing to go to great, extremes to get it. Eretz Yisrael, the Meraglim said, is a great, beautiful land. It's great, and the fruit is great, and we agree, it's a good land. Except, it's not good enough to want to really get. It's just theoretical. It's a great land, right, theoretically. But actually, there's no way of actually putting that into practice. The Marsha says that that's why they brought back of the seven kinds of things in Eretz Yisrael that Eretz Yisrael is praised with, right? What is that? Chita, Seora, right? Wheat and barley. Gefen is what's it called? Is wine, right? The grapes. And Te'ena is figs. And what's it called? Rimon, right? Rimonim. And what's it called? Tamarim, right? And dates. What did I skip? Zayas and olives. Okay. Of those seven things, what did the Meraglim bring back? Which things? They didn't bring back wheat. They didn't bring back barley. And they didn't bring back, what's it called, olives. What did they bring back? Grapes. And they brought back, what's it called, figs. Te'ena. Right? And they brought back a rimonim. What's it called? Pomegranate. Okay. What says the Marsha? What's the difference between the things they brought back and the things they didn't bring back? The things they brought back were not the staples of life. Not wheat and barley and what's it called? And oil you need for baking, cooking, whatever. That's the zayas. And tamarim, dates, are also nutritious. People can live off dates, the Gemara says. Those four things are staples. Which did they bring back? Figs. You can live without figs. You can live without wine. And you can live without pomegranates. Those are dessert. The other things are the staples. The Meraglim came back and said, you know what? Eretz Yisrael is a great place for dessert. But it's not a place for the staples of life. Meaning, what is not far from many people who don't live here's idea. They come here with their camera, right, and take slides to bring back to Chutz Laaretz, right, and they go touring or whatever, and they feel that Eretz Yisrael is like Disneyland. It's a place to visit, right? Nobody lives in Disneyland. It's not real, right? But it's a great place to come and take your slides and visit and enjoy. But real life is in Lakewood, Borough Park, Baltimore, Cleveland, wherever. That's where you really can live, right? Or England, or South Africa, or Australia, or whatever. That's where real life goes on. Eretz Yisrael is a great fantasy park to visit. Really great, but it's not, what's it called, it's not real. Can't really live here. right? As the joke goes, right, the person, what's it called, I think Ben-Gurion was the one who told over this thing, somebody came to live in Eretz Yisrael and he found that the conditions really oppressive. So he said, you know, when I came here, what's it called, to look, check it out, it didn't seem so bad. He said, I'll tell you. He said, there was somebody who once died clinically, and he went up to Shemayim, and they said, while you're here already, we're sending you back, but while you're here already, we'll show you around. So they took him to Gan Eden, and they showed him that people were sitting and learning Torah, what's it called, at the big tables, and that's Gan Eden. Then they took him to Gehenna, and they showed him people partying and having a good time and eating and drinking. So he realized that, you know, Gehenna is not such a bad place, and Gan Eden seems to be boring. Everybody's sitting and learning Torah. So when he actually died, and he came back to the pearly gates, as they say, so the angel there said, you know, we're to give you a choice. You can go to Gehenna, or you can go to Gan Eden. He said, you know, I was here before, and I think Gehenna is more my style. I'd like to go to Gehenna. So fine. Put him in Gehenna. Comes to the Gehenna, and they take him and throw him into a pot of boiling oil, what's it called, and start torturing him, hanging from his hands on the wall. He says, wait a second. I was here before, right? And people were eating, drinking, partying. What happened? He said, no, before you were a tourist. You know, now you're here for good. Right, different story. Same thing Ben-Gurion told him. He said, before you're here as a tourist, that's one thing. Now you're living here, it's a different story. So that's what people think. You can't live there. It's a nice place to visit. It's like Disney World. Nobody lives in Disney World. You come, take your pictures, go home and tell your stories, and that's it. But to actually live here, that's not shy. That's what the Meraglim said. We're bringing back, dessert is great there. You can have figs and pomegranates and a lot of grapes, but staples of life, the wheat, the barley, the oil, and the, what's it called, and the date, forget about it. That's not for Eretz Yisrael. That's called Vayimosu Be'eretz Chemda. Right? It's a nice land, but it's not desirable enough to put into practice. And that is a mistake. If God said you can do it, then you can put it into practice. It's not just something theoretical. And every mitzvah is like that. Yecheskel Avramsky says that if a mitzvah would be impossible, God wouldn't demand it of us. He only demands things of us that are possible to do. And the proof is the case of Esh Yifas Torah. When you go out into battle, so the Torah permits you to take a captive woman and put her through a conversion process and live with her. Why? Because God knew that under the circumstances, a man would not be able to control himself. So the Torah permitted it under certain conditions. That means, says the wife of Rabbi Cheskel Avramsky, that if it's impossible, the Torah didn't prohibit it. And if the Torah prohibited it, that means it's possible. If the Torah demanded you to do something, or prohibited you, right? If it would be impossible, it wouldn't permit, prohibit it, or demand that you do it. V'haraya, look at Esh Yifas Torah. The Torah said it's impossible, and therefore it's okay. So if it's not okay, that means it's possible to do. If you have to do it, that means it's possible to do. So the Torah gave a mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael. It's possible to live in Eretz Yisrael. It's not something that's only possible theoretically. Man-made religions, right, make things that are impossible to do, but they're the ideal of the religion. Right? Turn the other cheek. No Christian ever turned the other cheek except for the people that they were torturing. Right? They turned their other cheeks. But they never did it. Love your enemy. The Torah doesn't demand you to love your enemy. Nobody can realistically love their enemy. The Torah demands you love your neighbor, not your enemy. Right? The Torah demands things that are possible to do. Fake religions demand things, ideals that are never possible, but it's not a realistic religion anyway, so therefore make it look good. But nobody ever could do that. For the Rabbanu Shlom created us, he knows what we can do. He doesn't demand from us things that we can't do, that he didn't create us to be able to do. So in any case, that is one way of understanding Vayimosu Be'eretz Chemda. They looked at Eretz Yisrael as something desirable enough to visit, but not desirable enough to put into practice. That's called chemda. Okay. It says that, what's it called? Another thing about Eretz Yisrael. When they came back, so Kalev and Yoshua said, Tova ha'aretz ma'od ma'od. The land is very, very good. Now that doesn't seem to be quantifiable. How much is very, very good more than just one very good? And how much is it less than three very, very, very good? What does that mean, very, very good? So some say it means, ma'od, ma'od means as much as it could possibly be. It's the best it could be. But I have a different idea what it means. It says by Avraham Avinu that the Rabbanu Shem told him, lech lecha me'artzecha. Rashi says, lecha, lech lecha, for your sake. Lehanoscha uletovoscha. For your pleasure and for your good. That's what the Rabbanu Shem told. If you go to Eretz Israel, I'm telling you it's going to be for your pleasure and for your good. What does that mean? There are many things in this world that are good for you, but they're not pleasurable. I knew when my mother, Aleha Shalom, said, eat your vegetables, they're good for you, they didn't taste good. Because she wouldn't have to resort to how good they were for me if they tasted good. So there are a lot of things that are good for you, but they're not enjoyable. And there are a lot of things in this world that are enjoyable and they're not good for you. The Rabban Shem told Avraham Avinu, I promise you, Eretz Yisrael is not only good for you, it's enjoyable too. And both miles. It's good for you and it's also enjoyable. Right? That's Eretz Yisrael. Sometimes if you don't have the right lenses, you don't see that it's good for you or that it's enjoyable. If you have the right lenses, you can see that it's good and enjoyable. They tell the story of Rabbi Menachem Mendel Mivitebsk, who came to Eretz Israel, I think in the middle 1800s, the end of the 1800s, and 40 days after he was here, he made a big party for his Talmidim. So they asked, what's the occasion? You made a siyum, what exactly are we celebrating? He said, I'll tell you. Before I left Europe, a Mekubal told me that when I get to Eretz Israel, I will see that every rock in Eretz Israel is a diamond. I got off the boat, and I didn't see any diamonds. I saw plenty of rocks, no diamonds. And I felt terrible. So I fasted every day for the last 40 days in the daytime and only ate at night. And I davened earnestly that the Rabbanu Shem should open my eyes. I should see the diamonds in Eretz Israel. And today I open the shutters and I see that every rock in Eretz Israel is a diamond. So you need the right eyes to be able to see it. Right? To what one person is a stumbling block, to other people is a diamond. It depends how you look at it. Depends what your standards and values are, what you're looking for in this world. I always like to give the example, the Nachash got a curse that it eats dust all of its life. So one interpretation, the Gemara says, is that the Nachash has no taste buds, and everything it eats tastes like dust. That's a curse. That's a curse. But another interpretation the Gemara says is that the Nachash is cursed, that wherever it goes, its food supply will be readily available like the dust. It looks like there's dust everywhere, there's food for the Nachash everywhere. It'll never be lacking for food. Now, that does not sound like a blessing. That does not sound like a curse. That sounds like a blessing. What kind of curse is that? Wherever you go, your food supply will be readily available. And the Jewish people in the Midbar got a blessing. They had one day's food supply, and if they tried to save it for the next day, it rotted, and they started out the new morning, if the mom didn't fall, with nothing. That was a blessing. So I never understood this until the following Maisa happened to me in Miami, and then I understood what the curse of the Nachash was and the blessing of Klal Yisrael. I had a woman in my kehillah who taught in the local public high school. She was a high school teacher. And she taught Hebrew. At that time in Miami, the Nemtsov, no one taught me that. The Goldsmith, Chaviva Goldsmith. She taught Hebrew. And at that point in Miami, Hebrew was an accepted second language in the public high school. Today, the accepted second language in Miami is English, since Spanish is the first language. So she taught Hebrew, and obviously most of her students were Jewish. She had some non-Jews who wanted to learn Hebrew, but most of the people who wanted to learn Hebrew were Jews. She called me one day, and she said, I have a 17-year-old boy in my Hebrew class in the public high school who has tried to commit suicide twice unsuccessfully, and we're afraid he's going to try a third time and be successful. And nobody can convince him not to try to take his life. He is despondent, depressed, and he's suicidal. And nobody can get through to him, not the guidance counselor, not the social workers, nobody. So, you know, he's a Jewish boy. Maybe you want to try to save a Jewish life. Can I bring him to you? Maybe you can convince him not to commit suicide. So I said, sure, bring him in. She brings me the 17-year-old boy. I never saw a sadder-looking individual in my life. He looked like he knew the world came to an end. I didn't know about it yet. Really depressed. So I said to him, you know, you're only 17 years old. What could have happened in your short life that makes you so despondent and depressed? He says, Rabbi, I'll tell you. He said, I've grown up with my father. I don't even know who my mother is. My mother abandoned me when I was an infant. My father's raised me. My father's a very wealthy man. And he's all I have in this world, really. And a few weeks ago, my father called me in. And he took out a set of keys from his right pocket. And he said, these are keys to a very fancy condominium that I bought you in a yuppie neighborhood in Miami, fully furnished, fully paid for. It's yours. Enjoy it. Took his out of his left pocket another set of keys. He said, these are keys to a very fancy, expensive sports car. Fully paid for. I bought it for you. You need transportation. Enjoy it. Gives me the keys. Out of his wallet, he pulls a credit card on his name. He says, look, you need clothing, food, entertainment. I'm a wealthy man. Within reason, put it on the credit card. I'll pay the bill. Just one thing, though. I met a woman who I want to marry. And she made it clear to me that she'll only marry me on one condition, that you're not in the picture. So you have your house, you have your car, you have your credit card. It's nice knowing you. Have a good life. Don't call me. I won't call you. Don't come to visit me. I won't visit you. It's nice knowing you. Have a good life. Finish. I said to myself, I was much younger at the time. And I said to myself, if I would be 17 years old and I would have my own apartment, my own sports car, and unlimited credit, I do not think I'd be suicidal. I think I'd be pretty happy. So I wanted to tell this young man, you know, everybody has their peckle of sorrows. Everybody has their package of sorrows they carry around this world. You have yours, your credit card, your car, your apartment. I have mine. Let's switch. You give me your sorrows, I'll give you my sorrows. But then I realized that every time this kid lived in that apartment, or used that car, or used that credit card, it reminded him that nobody wanted him, that he was totally rejected and unloved, and nobody was totally rejected. That is a curse. That's what the Rabban Shalom told the Nachash. There have to be snakes in this world. I won't have anything to do with you. I'm going to give you your food supply till the end of time, but I won't have no connection to you. That's a curse. The Jewish people, the Rabban Shalom said, you're not going to have more than one day's food supply. But every day you're going to know that you have a Father in heaven who cares for you, who sends you down your daily bread in the shape of man. That's a blessing. So it depends what you're looking for. If you're looking for an abundance of food, but not a relationship to God, and you think that's a blessing, Eretz Yisrael may be a lot of rocks. If you're looking for a relationship with God, you may not have as much food or as much water, but you'll have a greater connection to the Rabban Shalom. If you consider that a blessing, then you have the right eyes. You'll see that Eretz Yisrael is good and pleasurable. But you need the right lenses to see it. In Kriya Shema, we say you should love the Rabban Shalom b'chol me'odecha, with all your ma'od. And the rabbis say two explanations of what ma'od is. One is with all your material possessions, things that give you pleasure, material possessions. And the second is b'chol mida u'mida shu mode b'cha. Whatever God measures out for you in this world, right, love him. Whether he measures out what appears to you to be good or appears to you to be bad, realize it's all for your good. Even the suffering in this world is for your good. So the word ma'od has two meanings according to this. One is what is pleasurable, and the second one is what's good for you. Tova ha'aretz ma'od ma'od. Just like the Rabban Shalom told Avraham Avinu, lech lecha, I'm sending you a land that's for your good and for your pleasure. That's what Kalev and Yoshua said. The land has both connotations of ma'od. It's the ma'od, the chol ma'odcha, your material possessions which give you pleasure, and it also the ma'od, the chol mida umida, whatever measure God measures out, may not be pleasurable, but it's good for you. Both things will exist in in Eretz Yisrael. So that's what it means, Tova Haaretz Ma'od Ma'od. One last thing. It says that Moshe Rabbeinu davened for Yehoshua. He didn't daven for the rest. So we said already one idea, since he was a leader, and when Klal Yisrael will have to deal with nature, so it was important to daven for him. He said, if the leader is off and doesn't understand what nature is, then the people for sure can't understand. But let me say a different shot. The Kitzush Al-Sheikh says that the reason Moshe davened for Yehoshua, because Yehoshua was more prone to come back with a bad report. Why? Because he came from Ephraim, who came from Yosef, who brought a bad report about his brothers. So it was in their blood. Bringing bad reports was in the blood of Shevet Yosef, right? And therefore, Moshe davened for Yehoshua, Ko Yoshiacha Me'atzes Meraglim. You, right, are prone to come back with bad reports because it's in your blood, so Moshe davened for him. Kalev, on the other hand, Moshe didn't daven for him, but Kalev went to daven that he should not give in to the Meraglim. He went to Kever Avos, he went to Maris HaMachpelah to daven. Why Dafka Kalev? Why not the other ten? Because Kalev was also prone to lying. Why? Because Yehuda, what's it called, lied to Yaakov. Came back and he said, you know whose coat this is? Right, and he lied to him and made him think that that Yosef was killed by a wild animal, knowing that they sold him as a slave. So Yehuda lied and Yosef lied, and therefore those two Shvatim needed special prayers. The only problem is, why did Moshe daven for Yehoshua, not daven for Kalev? And why did Kalev go and daven for himself and Yehoshua didn't go to Bar Machpelah? Why the difference? So I think there's two ways of lying. And Yehoshua and Kalev were prone to two different things. Yehuda lied out and out. He misrepresented the facts. He said something not factual. He made it appear that Yosef was killed by a wild animal, and he wasn't. It's a lie, open lie. So Kalev was prone to lying, right? It was in his blood. Yosef, on the other hand, lied differently. He didn't misrepresent the facts. He told his father exactly what the brothers were doing, except he interpreted the facts wrong. That was his mistake. He didn't misrepresent the facts like Yehuda did, but he interpreted the facts in a not proper way. Like the brothers were doing X, Y, and Z, and he interpreted what they were doing in a negative way when he could have looked at it a different way. So one was the interpretation of the facts. The other one was in the distortion of the facts. Two different kinds of lies. I think in the 60s or 70s, after the Vietnam War, then in America, so they used to have news, but it wasn't really news. It was commentary. But they didn't tell you it was commentary. So it wasn't the facts. It was their understanding or their interpretation of the facts. And people looked at it and they assumed this is the news. This is the fact. So they made a law in America that when you give commentary, you has to say on the screen, commentary. These are not necessarily the facts. This is our interpretation of the facts. So it's possible when a person has a predisposition to lying, it's in his blood, to totally misrepresent the facts. That's a Yetzer Hara. That's Bechira. That's something that you can, what's it called, you can daven for. Nobody else can daven for you that you should make the right choices, because I call bidei shemayim chutz miyira shemayim. Right? Everything is in God's hands except your moral choices. So when it came to what's it called, to Kalev, Moshe couldn't daven for Kalev that you make the right decision. He shouldn't lie. You have to make that decision. So Kalev, on the other hand, went and davened by the avos that the Rabbanu Shem should give me the power not to give in to say an out-and-out lie. Okay, that comes from midos roles, from bad midos, that you'll choose to mamish misrepresent the facts. So nobody else can daven that you should make the right choices, but you can daven that you should, the Rabbanu Shem should give you a help that, what's it called, that you should make the right choice. On the other hand, when it comes not to misrepresenting the facts, but misinterpreting the facts, That's much more dangerous. There, it's not a question that you think you're doing anything wrong. You think you're doing something right. You're not choosing to do something wrong. You're just misinterpreting what's going on. Then, davening for somebody else can help. You think you're doing right, so you can't daven for yourself. But somebody else can daven that the Rabbanu Shel Olam should enlighten your eyes, that you should see things in the proper light and not in the distorted light. So Moshe could daven for Yoshua, but he couldn't daven for Kalev, because they were both prone to different kinds of lies. Kalev had a daven for himself, but davening for himself would help, because he wouldn't. It's an open choice between lying and telling the truth. Yoshua couldn't daven for himself, because it's not an open choice between misrepresenting the facts. If you see it like that, you think you're doing the right thing. There you need somebody else to give you guidance, that the Rabbanu Shel Olam should let you see things the way they really are, so you don't give in to misinterpreting the facts. That's why Moshe davened for Yoshua, and Kalev had to daven for himself. Okay.